Today is Thursday, March 20th. We're starting a little bit late. We have a busy day here at the Senate, so we waited for a couple more colleagues to file in here. But we're going to go ahead and get started now. We have a really interesting informational hearing to the first part of our agenda today on consolidation and workers. I'm really looking forward to learning from the speakers that we have lined up, and we'll go ahead and begin. So first off, we'd like to welcome Justin Stoffrin, the Anti-Monopoly Director with the Minnesota Farmers Union. Welcome to the Senate Labor Committee.
Thank you, Chair McEwen and committee members. My name is Justin Stoffrin. I'm the Anti-Monopoly Director at the Minnesota Farmers Union, which is a grassroots general farm organization that's represented family farmers, ranchers, and rural communities across Minnesota since 1918. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today and thank the committee for holding space for this important discussion. I also recognize that MFU might be a bit of an unlikely organization to kick off this discussion, which is both why I'll try to keep my comments brief, but I also believe that we can provide some broader context that this conversation is situated within. When it comes to the issue of monopoly power, it can be easy to think about this as specific to one industry or a particular set of individuals. But as an organization that is focused on promoting fair markets and competition policy, we've come to realize that this is an issue that's pervasive across the economy. Over the last couple of decades, three-fourths of industries have become more consolidated. Since 2005, the economy has become 50% more consolidated, and at the current rate of consolidation, if we don't do anything, it's estimated that we'll have one company per industry by 2070. So you think of how alarming it can be if there's an industry with three or four companies that control 50, 60, 70% of the market. This would be one company, 100% of the market. Yet for too long, antitrust enforcement at both a state and federal level have focused very narrowly on impacts on consumers, which is why I believe a conversation like this one today is so important. We know that monopoly power does not just harm consumers, it has negative impacts for farmers, small businesses, communities, and as we'll hear from other testifiers today, workers. Another person that understood this was one of the original crafters of our antitrust laws. Senator John Sherman, author of the Sherman Antitrust Act, said in the 1890s that monopoly, quote, commands the price of labor without fear of strikes, for in its field it allows no competitors. Or, put the way that a member once said to me, the working class has gotten beaten up because of the loss of small businesses. According to a recent analysis by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, one of every eight labor markets in the United States is dominated by a single employer. The Treasury Department estimated in 2022 that workers are earning about 20% less than they would be if there was more competition in the economy. At MFU, we believe the state can play an important role in addressing these challenges, and I wanted to be here in part because antitrust policy and other sorts of measures, and I realize some of that would come through the Commerce and Judiciary Committees as opposed to this committee, but that those policy solutions are often not sector specific, meaning that the fight for fair markets so farmers can earn a fair price could also have positive impacts for workers. One recent example of this dynamic is the law legislators passed in 2023 to help address consolidation in healthcare, where not only does the Attorney General have to consider the impacts a merger would have on healthcare costs, but also the impacts on the healthcare workforce. While this committee is not discussing specific legislation on this topic today, we look forward to working with the members of this committee and the other committees that you serve on to help address our monopoly crisis. And if you ever want to have a riveting discussion about merger review or anti-competitive vertical restraints, I'm your guy. So thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. We'll just proceed through our speakers, and then hopefully at the end we can have a discussion and some questions. Next, we have joining us virtually, Doha Mekki. Am I pronouncing that last name correctly? The former Acting Assistant Attorney General for Antitrust with the U.S. Department of Justice. Welcome very much to the Minnesota Senate Labor Committee. We're very, very pleased and honored that you could join us today. Can you hear us okay?
I can hear you very well. Thank you.
Okay, great. Please go ahead and introduce yourself, and we're very much looking forward to what you have to share with us today.
Thank you so much, Chair McEwen. And I have to say, before I introduce myself, as someone who is married to a Minnesotan, really the privilege is very much mine today. And so I thank you for the invitation to be here, not only because I love talking about antitrust and labor, but because it has probably improved my standing with my in-laws. Chair McEwen, Vice Chair Hochschild, Ranking Member Dornick, and distinguished members of the committee, thank you so much for holding this hearing about consolidation and workers. My name is Doha Mekki, and for a decade, I had the privilege and honor of serving at the Justice Department's Antitrust Division, most recently as the Acting Assistant Attorney General in charge of the division. Before that, I served as Principal Deputy to Joe Biden's head of the Antitrust Division and as counsel to President Trump's first head of the Antitrust Division. All told, I served under three presidential administrations, under three Senate-confirmed leaders of the Antitrust Division, and four acting heads of the Antitrust Division before ultimately taking the helm myself. All of that is to say, I have seen many different approaches to antitrust enforcement, and I had a front-row seat to watching the real and durable convergence of antitrust interest from people of all stripes, including the political left and the political right. And I appear before you today privileged to share our experience establishing a comprehensive antitrust enforcement and policy approach that focuses on working people and labor markets. The most important thing this distinguished committee should know is that antitrust law is at least as concerned with the market opportunities of workers as it is for the consumer products and services that all of us enjoy in our commercial life. This is not novel or new. As Mr. Stofron just mentioned, the drafters of the Sherman Act of 1890, our first antitrust law in the United States, were concerned about the impact of monopolies on working people. And it wasn't even new in 1890. Writing more than 100 years before that, Adam Smith actually wrote in The Wealth of Nations that we rarely hear, it has been said, of the combination of masters, though frequently of those of working men. But whoever imagines upon this account that masters rarely combine is as ignorant of the world as the subject. Masters are always and everywhere in a sort of tacit but constant and uniform combination not to raise the wages of labor above their actual rate. And so there it is, the father of free market economics, worried about working people and how they get paid fairly and whether they get paid fairly by their employers. And so the roots of antitrust law make this concern plain, but it's also a sad fact of our earliest antitrust history in the United States that the antitrust laws were actually wielded against working people. Again, this is curious. The English common law that we imported into U.S. law may well have punished a non-compete as the first restraint of trade, which is part of the language of our Sherman Antitrust Act. And even after the United States Congress and the Supreme Court of the United States stepped in to make clear that the Sherman Act affects the market opportunities of working people and producers of all kind, whether you're an employee or a farmer or a doctor or a nurse or an author or some other kind of producer or worker, there was a yawning gap that spanned nearly a century before we at the federal level began to focus on labor markets with real discipline and focus. Starting in 2018, I helped lead an effort at the federal level to establish this comprehensive antitrust enforcement and policy program in labor markets. And this really had its roots in the aftermath of the financial crisis, when policy experts and agency officials and folks of all stripes really observed the two-tiered recovery from the financial crisis, which is to say that some people got back to where they were before the crisis happened, and some people suffered reduced wages and fewer opportunities. And so while there were many explanations for this, President Obama's White House Council of Economic Advisors really posited that maybe antitrust could be doing more. And so the antitrust agencies issued a guidance document in 2016 to make clear that antitrust enforcement can be used when employers abuse their monopoly power in labor markets, when mergers combine to reduce the opportunities of workers. And so the antitrust division really began this effort, to seed this effort, beginning in 2018. And so we filed a case against rail equipment companies that had implemented no-poach agreements affecting their workers. I had the distinct honor and privilege of arguing one of the first antitrust cases in an amicus brief on behalf of the United States to make clear that antitrust law reserves its harshest condemnation for these kinds of no-poaching arrangements and wage-fixing agreements. In 2019, I testified before the House Antitrust Subcommittee to explain how antitrust law can be used in the context of mergers, that in some cases it may be a criminal violation of the antitrust laws to enter into no-poach and wage-fixing agreements, that certain kinds of information sharing, right, so something short of a full-blown agreement also could be actionable under the antitrust laws. And so I reserved the remainder of my time at the antitrust division to making what had then been theoretical very clear. And so I was very honored to indict the first ever criminal wage-fixing case. During my time as principal deputy, we secured the first conviction of companies that had actually entered into a criminal conspiracy to reduce the wages of school nurses that helped special needs children. We filed a case against Cargill, Wayne Sanderson, and other chicken growers that had actually stood up a scheme to exchange wage and benefit information against slaughterhouse workers. We secured, through an amicus brief on behalf of the United States, a holding in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, finding that in some cases, when fast food franchises enter into no-poach agreements, that that too can be actionable under the antitrust laws. We filed a brief on behalf of the United States to make clear that when the NCAA limits the opportunities of college athletes, that that too is a concern of the antitrust laws. And there are so many more examples that I can mention. All told, we filed 6 briefs in the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals. We filed 10 statements of interest in state and federal trial courts to really protect working people in this country and to make clear that any employer, any individual who limited the free market opportunities of working people needed to be prepared to meet the federal Justice Department on the other side of that action. And I believe that workers in America are better off for those efforts. And so, to conclude my opening remarks, I would say that I had the privilege of going all around the country to talk to workers and producers of all stripes. And whether it was authors, right, who were affected by the attempted merger of Penguin Random House and Simon & Schuster, or cattle ranchers in South Dakota, or independent pharmacists in Ohio, we heard the same stories over and over again, which is that people were being squeezed, not just by high prices that they pay at the grocery store or to buy a house or to get their kids educated, but that even when they were dealing with their employers, right, and trading partners, as we say in antitrust world, that that squeeze was very real. And so there's plenty more work for us to do. This effort is not over. And I'm so pleased that states like Minnesota are taking up the effort, or considering taking up the effort, to think about antitrust law and labor markets. We had a wonderful partnership with your exceptional Attorney General, Keith Ellison, and his office, where we saw firsthand that they were also concerned about these issues and stood shoulder to shoulder with us to make sure that working people had plenty of opportunities in the market. So with that, I conclude, and I would be so pleased to answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you very much. Ms. Mackey, are you able to stick around while we have our other testifiers? Do you have a little bit of time?
Absolutely.
Okay, very good. We have four more people set to offer some testimony on this topic, and then I'd like to open it up for some questions, and I just want to make sure. I know I have some questions for you, and I wanted to make sure that I didn't need to ask them right away.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. Next, we have also joining us virtually, Leslie Kopp with SEIU.
Thank you, Chair McEwen and members of the committee. My name is Leslie Kopp. I live in Albert Lea. I am testifying on behalf of my union, SEIU, Healthcare Minnesota and Iowa.
Ms. Kopp, I'm sorry to interrupt you. We just need you to speak up a little bit more. We can hear you, but it's really quiet, and I just want to make sure that people that are listening who might have a little bit of a difficult time hearing are able to. So could you just start over again and just pick up the volume a wee bit? Thank you.
Yes, sorry about that. My name is Leslie Kopp. I live in Albert Lea, and I'm testifying on behalf of my union, SEIU, Healthcare Minnesota and Iowa. Our union represents over 50,000 workers in hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, and self-directed home care. For 10 years, I worked as a cook at the Albert Lea Mayo Hospital. Now I work in home care. I'm here to talk about how corporate power hurts healthcare and workers in my small city. Big corporations have the power to uproot and rearrange critical healthcare services for whole communities, almost without any checks by state or local government. In 1996, Mayo bought the Albert Lea Hospital, promising world-class healthcare services would continue, even expand. But gradually, Mayo has chipped away at healthcare in our community. In 2017, they announced that we would lose the intensive care unit, overnight medical and surgical stays, and the birthing unit. By late 2019, these were all gone. We now have an emergency department, same-day surgery, no overnight stays, mental health treatment and addiction treatment for men only. The Albert Lea Healthcare Coalition worked for years to recruit another medical provider, and Mercy One opened a clinic here in 2021, finally giving locals another option for medical care. They left after only 2 years. Once again, Mayo is the only option we have for comprehensive health care in our community. And Albert Lea is only part of the picture. At least 17 small town clinics in our region have been closed by Mayo since 2017. On a personal level, these same corporations have even more power over our relationships with health care providers. I've lived in this area for about 15 years, and I have lost count of how many different health care providers I've seen. A couple years ago, after more than 2 years of working in a hospital setting during COVID, I was dealing with pretty severe anxiety issues. I dropped down to part-time, and I finally made an appointment with someone I had never met, physician's assistant, to talk about several issues, including my anxiety and heart palpitations. She was really great, and she really listened and helped me work through and figure out what I needed. I met her one more time for a follow-up. Unfortunately, but not unexpectedly, within months, I got a familiar message in my patient portal from another healthcare provider saying they're moving on and that I should book my next appointment with yet another stranger, to whom I'll have to explain my medical history all over again. This is not conducive to building a trusting, confidential relationship, and it leads to poor health outcomes. Mayo Clinic is a nonprofit. Their motto is the needs of the patient come first. I'm not sure which patients this refers to. The wealthy, the world leaders who come, certainly not folks on any sort of assistance, or their own workers who have come out to say that the insurance Mayo provides is terrible. We need choices for our healthcare, not a monopoly. We need to use our collective power to make sure someone listens to the needs of patients and workers. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Ms. Kopp, are you also able to stick around a little bit for some discussion in a bit? Okay,
yes.
Great. Thank
yes,
you very much. Next, we have Kevin Pranis with Lyuna, Minnesota and North Dakota. Welcome, Mr. Pranis.
Thank you, Chair McEwen and committee members. Kevin Pranis, on behalf of Lyuna, Minnesota, North Dakota, represent 14,000 men and women who work alongside other building trades, building building civil and energy infrastructure. This is a very important topic and appreciate the time being taken today, even though there's not a bill for it. So I'll just briefly describe how the construction market is different from many other industries that face these consolidation problems, but how we are not immune from those same problems. So just about us, besides 14,000 members, we work with 800 partner contractors that employ those 14,000 members. So if you do the math, like a large majority of our contractors have 10 or fewer employees. So they are small, family-owned businesses overwhelmingly. Even the bigger ones are often family-owned businesses. And every year, we see members who leave their positions as general laborers or foremen or superintendents to forge their own path as small business owners. And while some fail, and end up back working with us, fortunately, where we still have benefits and decent pay, many succeed and end up employing dozens of other laborers. Thinking about, for example, in the broadband and distribution industry, we have a member who's a Panamanian immigrant, worked for years in the field, worked his way up, started his own business, now is a highly successful distribution contractor employing dozens of laborers. And so there are lots of opportunities in this industry for people to work their way up and then be able to actually succeed in building up new businesses. Prior to the work, my current work in construction, I worked for unions that represent food processing and grocery and freight and warehouse workers. And every time we tried to figure out how more workers could get better pay, benefits, and job protections, in those fields, it often felt like all roads led us to one or two or three companies that set market conditions, including labor conditions, not only for their own workforce, but for entire supply chains, sometimes going both directions. That was very hard to figure out how could workers ever get a better deal when there's only a few companies get to set those rules. I enjoy working construction in part because it is very, very different. We have large contractors, but no company dominates the construction market the way a few companies dominate other markets. It's a highly complex business, local in character, and we serve a very diverse set of customers. And so it's tough for any one company to sort of like figure out the magic solution that, you know, consolidates control of that market. And we like it that way. I think it's a lot of opportunity for businesses, also opportunities for workers. The union trade model also helps support a diverse ecosystem of large and small contractors, because what union trades provide is not only a level playing field where all of the contractors that are union are paying the same wages and benefits and not competing for the lowest like wages, but also we provide resources like health and retirement plans and training that small contractors could never provide on their own. In every conversation we have with a small contractor, you know, they might be paying 20, 30, 40% more than we are to get benefits that are maybe half as good, right, in healthcare. Just because we're negotiating on behalf of 14,000 members, they're negotiating on behalf of themselves and their 8 employees. And so that helps support that diverse market. There are some exceptions, though, and I want to talk about one particular area we've stumbled on in construction that looks very different to us based on extensive interviews with contractors and workers, and that's the installation of thin decorative stone veneer that you might see on many homes, hotels, similar commercial properties. You want it to look like stone, but you don't want to actually pay for stone construction, which is quite expensive and much more complicated. And so that sector of the industry used to provide good union jobs, overwhelmingly, that provide family supporting pay, benefits, apprenticeship opportunities for masons and tenders that we represent. But those opportunities are became fewer and fewer over the years. And what contractors observed was deteriorating conditions in the market where they would be underbid by maybe half, right, 40%, just astronomically lower rates that they couldn't possibly compete with. And generally speaking, their impression is they were being underbid by the largest single manufacturer of that stone, who also had a vertically integrated installation business. Environmental Stoneworks is an affiliate of a building material conglomerate called Cornerstone Building Brands and claims to be North America's only vertically integrated national manufacturer of installer of stone veneer. Unusually, they both manufacture and install. Generally, building supply, you know, product companies are not the same ones doing installation. That's contractors. In this case, they created what, as far as we can tell, is the largest contractor in the business installing their own stone. Often that stone is a required material, and so there's all kinds of advantages that you can imagine that a company in that position might be able to take. But in particular, what we found is they controlled the labor market. And so what happened originally, they started about 10 years ago with employees who were doing doing this at piece rate, fairly low wages. Then they discovered that there was a better model of pushing all those employees out, according to these workers, and forcing them to all become independent contractors, responsible, allegedly, for their own taxes and their own insurance, if that was even happening, right? And so those individuals got pushed out, and all of a sudden there was a network of so-called independent contractors that we think would not qualify even under the old definition of the independent contractor law in Minnesota. And we're talking more than 100 people every year for the past 10 years. Not one worker we talked to has ever received overtime, not as employees and not as so-called independent contractors. Incredibly low piece rates. And these workers say that when they would complain and say, like, are these rates are too low, we can't even make a living, like, we can't survive, you're making us own the truck, you're making us go get the propane, you're making us do all this stuff that we didn't used to be responsible for, and yet you haven't, like, in years, you haven't changed the piece rates at all, never mind paying overtime. And the answer was, feel free, there's the door, I got 10 more people that'll come, you know, that'll take this work if you don't want it. Because the truth was that they were the dominant installer of thin stone, and many of those workers were doubtful that they could ever get employment or any kind of continuous employment if they didn't accept work from this company. We also found in the manufacturing facility other immigrant workers contacted us and described stories of discrimination that I think are the most egregious that we've ever seen. Differential pay, rest breaks, kinds of jobs, right? Specifically for immigrant workers who are working for that company. And so we see in that consolidation, certainly we have these problems with small contractors all over, but when you have one contractor that dominates an industry, the way that this one does makes it difficult or impossible for other contractors to effectively compete, and then builds a labor system that is based on the need to take their work at any price that they're willing to offer. We think that's the kind of risk that we need to avoid, that largely we avoid in construction. And happy to answer questions and appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Kelly Higgins, PAC, I have it listed. Okay. Welcome to the Senate Labor Committee. If you could please introduce yourself for the record, and we look forward to your testimony.
Thank you, Chair McCann and members of the Labor Committee. My name is Kelly Higgins. I'm a physician assistant, and I'm here today as a member of the Essentia Advanced Practice Provider Union, represented by Minnesota Nurses Association. The Essentia APP Union represents over 400 PAs, nurse practitioners, certified nurse midwives, and clinical nurse specialists that are trained, licensed, and dedicated to serving patients across the northern and central Minnesota and bordering communities. In my 11 years at Essentia Health, I've watched as smaller community hospitals and clinics are merged into ever-enlarging healthcare systems. In a two-hour radius from my hometown in Duluth, for example, Sandstone, Moose Lake, Aurora, Virginia, and Deer River have all been absorbed by Essentia. This has created what is undoubtedly a regional healthcare monopoly in northern Minnesota. Now, Essentia is pushing to merge with the mHealth Fairview system, creating an even larger healthcare monopoly and using monopsony power, which could leverage more unfair control over wages and working conditions by eliminating market competition. I also work a second job where I commute 3 hours from home to provide care at a rural community hospital, one of the few remaining in the state which retains its independent nonprofit status. In contrast to Essentia, leadership there is both accessible and responsive, and employees feel valued and respected. The community benefits when healthcare workers' needs are met. Workers at larger healthcare corporations deserve the same respect that I'm witnessing at the smaller facilities. When it comes to healthcare, bigger is not better. As Essentia grows, we feel less valued. Rather than being treated as the skilled healthcare professionals we are treated like cogs in a machine, in an organization which identifies as not-for-profit and has a duty to our community members, including ourselves, yet is fixated on growing profits and expansion of market power. Ongoing expansions have contributed to increasing worker dissatisfaction due to changes in the workplace, yet we have fewer local alternatives for employment because Essentia has monopolized our region. Thus, we are forced to relocate, often out of state, or leave healthcare entirely. Not only has Essentia neutralized competition through mergers and acquisitions, but they are also demonstrating other monopolistic behaviors through non-compete agreements. despite established antitrust laws and recent state law changes prohibiting worker non-competes moving forward, Essentia refuses to dissolve existing non-competes. Essentia states they're committed to improving access to healthcare, yet these non-competes restrict healthcare providers from delivering care unless Essentia directly profits from the services rendered. This is in spite of our community's needs for increased services and access to care, especially in rural underserved areas. Essentia's increasing disconnect between upper management and the labor force is what led to me supporting APP unionization in the first place. Despite clear instruction from the NLRB to bargain, Essentia refuses to meet with APPs at the negotiation table, continuing instead to make unilateral changes to our working conditions in violation of labor law. This is not a healthy or functional approach to labor relations. This is not the purpose of today's hearing, I understand, but it is relevant in that the optics seem to be that Essentia has grown so large as to believe that they are above the law. Essentia's practices restrict workers' options, limit provision of care to our communities, and effectively drive healthcare workers out of our communities or out of working in healthcare altogether. As Essentia continues to look toward a bold new vision, as they call it, in their proposals with the U of M, I ask you, our lawmakers and representatives, to stand up for us. As Minnesotans, as taxpayers, as caregivers, and as the healthcare labor force of our state, we ask that you please hold Essentia accountable. And remember, bigger is not always better, especially without real safeguards for patients, communities, and healthcare workers. Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for allowing me to testify today, and I look forward to any questions you have.
Thank you very much. And last in this part of our agenda today, we have Hannah Alstead with the Teamsters. Welcome to the Senate Labor Committee this afternoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name's Hannah Alstead. I'm the political director for Teamsters Joint Council 32, and we represent 80,000 active and retired members across Minnesota, North and South Dakota, Iowa, and Wisconsin. The Teamsters are committed to advancing a pro-worker antitrust agenda, and we welcome the opportunity to talk about that here today. My testimony will focus on the corporate giant that we think is engaging in anti-competitive behavior that is driving down wages in the core industries that Teamsters represent, Amazon. Over the years, corporate-friendly rulings from the judiciary have hollowed out our antitrust laws, draining them from their original spirit and distorting their purpose. There's one key aspect of antitrust that we think needs to be explored. While it's true that antitrust law deals with collusion between companies prohibiting bad mergers that might drive down wages and worker conditions, it's important to remember that antitrust laws also have been concerned with coercion or cases in which a powerful company exercises oppressive control over other captive companies lower down in the supply chain or those companies' workers. That's exactly what's happening at Amazon, where the company has been driving down wages and working conditions in the Teamsters' core industries of warehousing and logistics, and its sham delivery service partner subcontractor model. As numerous congressional oversight efforts have demonstrated in recent years, although they drive Amazon vans, wear Amazon vests, deliver Amazon packages, and operate according to quotas and routes determined by Amazon, Amazon says that its delivery drivers are not its employees. Instead, the company maintains that its drivers are employees of supposedly independent delivery service partners, in which reality they're just captive third-party contractors who have virtually no independence in how they run their business since Amazon sets all the rules while denying any liability. Now that Amazon has grown to be the largest delivery service company in the country by package volume, its low-road business practices are placing tremendous downward pressure on the hard-won middle-class wages and working conditions that the Teamsters have fought to achieve at unionized employers like UPS and DHL. Antitrust law used to have something to say about these sorts of control without responsibility business models. In the form of horizontal price fixing standards, as well as vertical restraint doctrines, but years of corporate-friendly court decisions have eroded this law. As the legislature considers updates to our antitrust law, low-road business models like Amazon's DSP program must be at the center of the conversation. We can and must create a pathway to a middle-class living at mega corporations like Amazon to bring them to the dignified middle-class standards that our union has established at UPS and DHL. The only way to do that is to force corporations like Amazon to make a choice. Either they are the employers of their drivers or for purposes of labor and employment law, and they have an obligation to recognize and bargain when their drivers unionize, or they are not employers and should therefore be subject to penalties under antitrust and unfair competition laws when they use their power to exercise coercive control over captive subcontractors like their DSPs. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify, and I will remain here with any other questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Well, that concludes our testimony for the informational part of our hearing. I would love to open this up to members' questions or comments about all of the conversation that we had. Perhaps Mr. Stofferen, if you wouldn't mind coming up to the table, and then if there are questions for specific testifiers, they can also kind of come and join up at the table. Any members? Yes, Senator Gruenhagen, why don't you kick us off?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I guess I'm most familiar with health care, so I was thinking of Kelly Higgins. I don't know if you want to come forward or not. But, you know, I've sold health insurance since 1978. I own an independent insurance agency now. But so I've kind of, you know, I actually sold health insurance when there was no networks and no pre-certification. Plus, municipalities tend to own the local hospital, and then you had an independent clinic that was owned by the doctors. And they were separate. And it seemed to work pretty good. But what, you know, from my observation, it's all this consolidation, I'll agree, has a lot of concerns and problems. And people are sometimes treated more as a pawn than a person. And what I see is that as the private health insurance market, well, let me just say this quickly. I was on a Zoom meeting invited by the lead lobbyist for hospitals about a year ago. And I had six hospital CEOs on there. Two were from the Metro, Hennepin County Medical Center, and I think Fairview was the other one, if I remember right. And then four from outstate. But they all said the same thing. They said, for every $2 of expenses, under medical assistance in Minnesota care, they get a dollar reimbursement on average. So they lose a dollar. On Medicare, they get about $1.50 for every $2 of expenses. So they still lose money, but not as much. On private insurance, they get reimbursed on average about $2.50 compared, so they make a little bit of money. The problem is you have more and more government reimbursement and less private insurance, thanks to Obamacare, in my opinion, all right? So the result is that what drives these consolidations is not only increasing cost, which we know the new technology is expensive for these medical facilities, but then you have low reimbursement from government plans, which aggravate the situation, and the result is you see the consolidation, and you have now, instead of my local doctors and hospital deciding what care you have somebody in an ivory tower trying to figure out the best way to maximize the most profit out of that particular facility. And the result is patients, doctors, and the nurses and para nurses or whatever suffer. And then on top of that, and I could go on more, but I'll just hit the main points, you have a government that corrupts our monetary system, okay, and prints up money out of nowhere. And the result is you get this type of exploitation because the people who are closest to the exploitation of the monetary system profit the most through the laws, and then they turn around and take the money that they get from those laws and they exploit the rest of the people and consolidate them. And so when we look at some of these problems, one of the things we need to do is look in the mirror and realize that we've caused a lot of them through excessive government reimbursement at a lower than cost rate to our medical facilities and the corruption of our monetary system. And I know, well, that's hard to solve. Well, then we try to come along with state government and micromanage and mandate things, and 9 times out of 10, we make things worse than what they were before. So there is a way out of this, okay? But I don't have that much time. But I did write a book on how to get out of this, if you'd like. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Gruenhagen. If you have any response, feel free to give any response you'd like to, and we'll continue our discussion.
Certainly, yeah. I'm looking for the question in that, but I think one thing we can agree on certainly is that I think as the cost of healthcare does increase and reimbursement is decreasing, the solution is not putting more pressure on the workers and having this burgeoning administrative system that I think for every worker, there's got to be a pretty close ratio of how many administrators there are to actual healthcare workers. So I do think that a lot of the healthcare expenses go towards cost for upper administration.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Go ahead, follow up, Senator Gruenhagen.
No, you could have said, I agree with you, Glenn. No.
Thank you.
Just kidding. No, but you're actually hitting the point right, because if you do your research, you're going to find that between the hospital bureaucracy, the government bureaucracy, state and federal, and the insurance bureaucracy, we're talking, depending on the estimate, between 40 and 50 cents of every dollar of premium going to bureaucracy to micromanage the doctor-patient relationship. That's what we've done with Obamacare. That's why your premium skyrocketed under Obamacare and your deductible skyrocketed, because it didn't do anything for the doctor-patient relationship. It just bloated the bureaucracy. And the result is we've got this huge bureaucracy that does nothing for the doctor-patient relationship other than micromanage it and make everybody miserable. And then you want to do certain treatments for people, and you've got to do an appeals process 6 to 8 different times to finally get that through. That's the problem. Yeah. And it can be solved, but we're going the wrong direction. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, just for a minute, I agree with about a portion of what Senator Gruenhagen said, certainly about the consolidation. And I think that the speaker from Albert Lea pointed out, I mean, a hospital system made decisions not based on the needs in the community, which is why they basically shut down the hospital. They made decisions based on a corporate model, which is a problem. And as Senator Gruenhagen pointed out, it's about consolidation is a huge problem. I also think that we should be replacing our heavily, as you point out, heavily bureaucratic system and removing a whole bunch of the regulations from getting rid of insurance industry, everything else. Just we put it all in the patient-provider relationship where the doctors and other health professionals are making decisions with their patients. And as Senator Gruenhagen rightly pointed out, we spend so much on our dollars in terms of that. But in terms of this issue here, I think I am very afraid of what's happening and the way it crushes workers and, frankly, crushes the economy. So I think this is a very important hearing. I guess I had one question, and it's maybe for Ms. Alstead, maybe it's for Mr. Stoffren, but in the last case with Amazon drivers, sounds like they're absolutely misclassifying them. They're driving Amazon trucks, delivering purely Amazon products on Amazon schedule, everything else, and they are not classified as employees. Is that being challenged?
Would anyone like to speak to that, Mr. Stoffren or Ms. Alstead?
Chair, Senator Marty, the only thing I'll defer a little bit to Ms. Alstead, but Ms. Meckey may also have points in terms of, I think one of the interesting things about the misclassification conversation, and as I know it, right, I'm not cannot claim to be heavily involved in that, but is that a lot of the focus that the legislature's had thus far is on sort of, you know, labor regulations around that misclassification. But there's also maybe some antitrust tools that could be brought, as Ms. Alstead kind of referred to, particularly around what are known as vertical restraints, and that's something we're sort of talking to partners and stakeholders about.
Could you explain to us a little bit more about vertical restraints and what you're referring to when you say that, when you use that term of art?
Yeah, I will. I'll give an attempt, and then I may phone Ms. Mecki as sure. as a friend. But essentially, at the broadest level, vertical restraints are sort of contractual agreements, right? But there are ways that those contractual agreements can be used in an anti-competitive fashion. And so, you know, non-competes is one of those sorts of examples.
Great, thank you. Ms. Mecki, are you following our discussion online there?
I am, and I will say that Mr. Stofron explained it brilliantly. If I may just follow up, you know, it's really been the Federal Trade Commission that's done most of the work with respect to Amazon. But I will say, without commenting on any specific company, that the committee is right to be concerned about, you know, misclassification. And when I was at the Justice Department, we filed briefs to make clear that when a company has monopoly power or market power and misclassifies its workers, it may not only be committing a violation of the antitrust laws in that labor market, but it may actually be having an impact, a negative impact on competition in the product market, because it makes it unfair and harder for honest businesses to compete where they do abide by the law and classify their workers properly and pay them properly and give them proper benefits and treat them well under federal and state labor standards. And so, again, the committee is right to be focused on this issue.
Thank you. Yep. Follow up. Thank you for that.
Yes, thank
Senator
you.
Senator Marty.
Thank you all for those comments. Yeah, it seems to be a mix of antitrust problems and worker classification ones, but it's clearly unfair to the workers who have these guidelines and they're not an employee and they have no choice. It's clearly unfair to the consumers. It's clearly unfair to the competing businesses that can't get into it. And I mean, when you have one company that big that any small business trying to compete with them, they can't. You can only do it by their rules and they get the money out of it and there's no way you can do it around it. So I appreciate what you're raising here today, and it ties in very closely with how worker standards are, worker class misclassification ties in, because it all fits in there together. So, thanks. I was just kind of surprised to hear how little they have protection.
Yeah. I have a question along this topic that I just wanted to ask really quick. I'm wondering if at the state level, and this could be for Ms. Mecki or any of our testifiers who want to weigh in on this, but as we look at possible solutions at the state level here in Minnesota, this committee will be working on these types of issues the best that we can. What are some of the avenues that you think would be the most productive toward protecting workers against these types of consolidations, most effective at the state level and could complement best some of the work that is done, hopefully, and continues at the federal level?
Chair, I would be honored to take that question in the first instance. One thing that the states can do, again, the states are always closest to the people, especially relative to the federal government. One thing that you could do is to make clear in state consumer protection and antitrust statutes that misclassification is in fact a violation of the antitrust laws. And second, to increase budgets for state antitrust enforcement to actually go after these employers that violate the law in these ways. Deterrence is incredibly important, and holding up real examples of enforcement against companies that do this is very powerful and I think a very good use of taxpayer dollars.
Thanks for that. Mr. Stofron, yeah.
Chair, the only thing I would add, those are sort of where my head went and some of the things that we've supported or at least are having discussions about at Farmers Union. We've also had, in addition to that misclassification piece, sort of starting to have some conversations with different experts and folks on spelling out clearly different vertical restraints. It would be a clear violation of the antitrust laws. I think, at least in my opinion, our challenge when it comes to our competition laws is sort of there's the under-enforcement piece and the resources piece, but there's also sometimes, I feel like I hear often, well, that kind of practice is probably technically illegal under antitrust law, and I think, you know, making it clearer is a potential pathway. And then the only other thing I'll mention is we have been working on legislation that would clearly define monopsony power, which I think was mentioned by a couple of folks, which is sort of the buyer side of monopoly power. Clearly creating a definition around that and clearly identifying it as a violation of state antitrust law. I think it's, you know, the argument, at least from, I don't want to speak for them, but I think the argument from the AG's staff would be that currently constitutes a violation of the antitrust laws, but making it very clear in statute.
Okay, thank you. Senator Umar Verbaeten.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you all for being here today. I just wanted to jump in on the misclassification conversation, as that's an issue that's really important to me. I served on the Attorney General's task force, and then a number of the recommendations that have come out of that I've carried, including the establishment of the intergovernmental partnership that now exists between a number of agencies, but primarily DLI and Deed Revenue. So something that I feel like I've seen come up in our conversations about potential misclassification, especially with sort of like gig workers, is that they don't have an ability to negotiate their contracts, really. And so we are being told that these folks are independent contractors. And I also think there's a lot of misinformation around the only way to have flexibility in your work is to be an independent contractor and that you can't have that as an employee. But if this person is like a business and this is a business to a business relationship, you should be able to like negotiate the terms of your contract. But that is just not the experience, I think, for a lot of those workers. So I would love if you could weigh in on that. And then I'm just wondering if there's anything else that you would mention in terms of the antitrust approach to misclassification. I heard you on just making it clear that it is a violation of antitrust laws, but are there other things from like the 2023 merger guidelines that you would point out for us as well? Thanks.
After you, anybody who would like to weigh in?
Thank you, Chair. I heard 2023 merger guidelines, which are near and dear to my heart, and so I take that as an invitation to weigh in. A few thoughts. The 2023 merger guidelines, which were issued by the U.S. Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission, that sort of explained to the public, businesses, individuals, families, and really everyone, how the antitrust agencies think about mergers and whether they violate the antitrust laws, actually include for the first time a standalone labor statement to make clear that mergers will be assessed for their impact on working people. And I was very proud to see under my tenure the very first solely focused labor side merger challenge that actually succeeded after trial. That was the Penguin Random House Simon & Schuster matter, where the agency filed a case challenging the merger, not because the price of books may go up, but because payments to authors may actually go down. Separately, one of the last things I worked on when I was at the Justice Department was a policy statement about how antitrust applies to business activities affecting workers. And we clearly delineated in that document that misclassification abuse of monopsony power, abuse of bargaining power, certain gamesmanship related to unionized workers or efforts to bargain collectively may well risk antitrust lawsuits at the federal level. And so I would commend both of those documents to you. No doubt they were shared with our state enforcement partners. And I believe that they are a sound statement of law and policy that can be followed at the state level if the state so chooses.
Thank you.
Chair, Senator, one other thing I would add is I know a couple of states have been looking at sort of broadening their, a lot of states have healthcare specific merger review laws because of how that sort of, fits into the regulatory environment. But there are states that are looking at broader merger review. And a component of that merger review could be, consideration of labor market impact. So that may be an area as well to explore in addition to some of the other ideas that have been discussed here.
Thanks. I had a question that may be, I'm not sure if this is a good question or not, but I am interested to know the answer, especially because we've had a couple of speakers, testifiers today that were dealing with issues of hospital consolidation. And it has always sort of confounded me. I understand pretty well the impetus for a private company to want to grow and grow and grow to maximize profits. But when you have an entity that is classified as a nonprofit, I think it's sort of confounding for a lot of people, including me. Why are these entities trying to just grow and grow and grow? But they are. We're seeing these closures all over the place and this consolidation happening in the healthcare space with hospitals and hospital systems. And I'm wondering if our antitrust laws and the laws that we have on the books, if they have a different application toward nonprofit entities than they do toward for-profit entities, and if that makes any difference at all.
Chair, I know that at a federal level, there can be some, I think in particular that the Federal Trade Commission has some gaps in terms of enforcement towards nonprofits, and I'm sure that Ms. Mecki can either add or correct me if I've stumbled on that. I believe at a state level, although I'd have to, I'll report back to you, but I don't know that there is that sort of distinction, but it might also get blurred by the fact that the Attorney General is both enforcing antitrust law as well as nonprofit law, and so there may just be some more natural synergy there.
Sure, thank you. Ms. Mecki, did you have any insight into that?
Thank you, Chair. Again, Mr. Stofran is exactly right. There are times when not-for-profit entities are actually carved out of the Federal Trade Commission's jurisdiction, but the Justice Department did review, healthcare consolidation involving, not-for-profits. I think the most important point here is that classification as a not-for-profit does not exempt any institution or entity from antitrust scrutiny. And so when I was at the Justice Department, we filed briefs, for example, against colleges and universities that had been alleged to have price fixed on college financial aid, which we found extraordinary, and took great pains to spell out why that was unlawful under the antitrust laws. And the same is true of not-for-profit healthcare institutions as well.
Thank you for that. Yes. Ms. Higgins, sorry.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate the insight of everybody else who's sharing, and I will be very plain that I'm not coming with a strong governmental background or understanding of policy, which is part of why I'm here today, is looking to build relationships, hear from the people who know and understand the relationships and where we need to go as workers. What I can say that I've observed with nonprofit organizations is that
I think in some ways, because they appeal to the emotional nature that has allowed them to enjoy a nonprofit status anyways, they become a little bit easier to allow movement and expansion in ways that we maybe would look at under more closer scrutiny if it was another organization. And I say that looking at healthcare as my narrow lens, but I think it can be applied to other nonprofits as well. At the same time, those nonprofits, there's personal gain as they grow, and we see that in the wages of healthcare CEOs. So we all share the same goal of wanting to improve healthcare delivery across Minnesota. I think the difference is that we see a different way to accomplish those goals, and expansion is not always the answer.
Thank you very much. Yes, Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, just one comment on that, and I think she's exactly right that nonprofits should not be treated differently than that. The consolidation is a big problem there, and in the healthcare field, much of it is, as you said, nonprofits.
Yeah. Well, Senator Gernhagen.
As long as we're on healthcare again, happens to be my wheelhouse. Anyway, the other thing I'd add is because of the low government reimbursement. That stresses the system, the healthcare system, leads to consolidations. While you have increasing expenses with low reimbursement, I belong to a committee of retired doctors, some insurance executives for about 4 to 5 years. We used to meet once a month, although lately we haven't met as much. But they all basically agree that we are headed, if we keep going down the path we're going, okay, we are headed to a two-tier healthcare system. One for the rich and the connected, and a second-rate one for the rest of us, okay? That's what's coming. And I could even give you examples from Mayo Clinic of medical professionals that would support that position. I'll give you one last example. I think it was last session, we had the Nurses Association to promote a bill that would have told hospital CEOs the ratio of patients they could assign to that nurse. So you couldn't exceed that or there'd be penalty. So it didn't pass, okay? But the point is, when you see the constantly low reimbursement coupled with exponentially growing higher cost, the next thing you know, these CEOs, which I agree, they take care of themselves first, they start stressing the nurses in terms of the care they give. Well, then the nurses turn around and say, well, now we need a law that decides how many patients I can take care of at a time, taking away managerial rights from the from the administration of the hospital. And then you could have empty beds in a hospital where a patient comes in that needs a hospitalization immediately, and because you have this ratio from the nurses, then you can't even put the patient in that bed. So again, that bill didn't pass, but I'm just saying, if we continue down this path, this is where we're going, okay? It's not gonna get better, it's gonna get worse. And if we go to single payer, it's gonna get exponentially worse. In terms of addressing the bureaucracy, I introduced a bill, and I had hoped Senator Marty would sign on to it, reference-based pricing that gets rid of a lot of the bureaucracy in the networks, but that's another story. So, okay.
Thank you, Senator Gernhagen. It sounds like you and Senator Marty should get together for lunch and talk some of this stuff out. I want to say a huge thank you to all of the people who came to help educate us today about the issue of consolidation and monopoly. And there's a lot more, I think, I know for me to learn. And I also didn't get to the point I wanted to talk a little bit about. I thought it was really illuminating how in the construction trade, some of the examples and the stability that we've seen comes, it sounds like to me, from organized labor being able to provide a sort of baseline of standard of living for the people doing that work so that competition amongst smaller businesses can really thrive and they aren't they aren't squeezed out as much because we're not putting so much of that on the smaller businesses. And I want to get into that a little bit too. Maybe we can develop that at some time. But thank you very much. We're running out of time, so I'm going to wrap things up. If anyone wants to say any quick last words, please feel free to do that. I know we've had a good discussion today.
Thank you all for your time today.
Thank you very much. So thank you to Mr. Stoferin, Ms. Mecki joining us remotely. Thank you for giving us your time today. Ms. Kaup, Mr. Pranis, Ms. Higgins, and also Ms. Alstead. Thank you very much for your expertise and sharing it with us today.
Thank you.
Next on our agenda, we have Senate File 2235, and Senator Mann has joined us to present her bill. Welcome, Senator Mann, to the Senate Labor Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Senate File 2235 is a very simple but important bill. So I initially ran for office because of two things, inhalers and insulin. I would be in the clinic seeing a child who needed an inhaler, and I would get a call from that family at the pharmacy saying, I can't get it, it's too expensive. And then I would go to my ER shift that weekend and see that same child having an asthma attack because they couldn't get their inhaler. So I would just really mad all the time because I was feeling like we were in a system that wasn't taking care of our patients. So when we passed 62Q.481 saying that a health plan cannot charge more than $25 a month for a supply of inhalers or insulin, that was really incredible. Unfortunately, we can't mandate that from self-insured plans due to federal law. So what this bill does is that it says that if you, as a large employer with a self-insured plan, choose not to abide by cost-sharing requirements in 62Q, which you don't have to, that you just put that on a job posting. People need to know if they have asthma or diabetes, a ballpark of what their life-sustaining medications are going to cost out of pocket. That's it, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Senator Mann. Senator Mann, does this bill need to go anywhere else, or are we free to just lay it over? I just wanted to make sure that we're on the same page about the path.
Madam Chair, members, I had not flagged this to have to go to another committee, but okay. That's up for discussion, I guess.
Okay, thank you. Well, then our intent would be to lay the bill over, but unless there's any objection. Members, is there any discussion or questions for Senator Mann? Yes, Senator Liske.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Mann, for expressing similar reasons as to why I got involved in politics. Taking care of my patients was definitely at the top of the list. Different reasons of why, but similar causes, right? Government seems to be a constant question on what's going on, and I find the bill interesting, and my concern, I guess, I'm going to give you my concern. I don't think I'm opposed. I'm just concerned that if we start down this path of requiring and mandating listing of certain benefits, how long is that job listing going to end up getting? Because at the end of the day, I also would have questions of, do I have investment accounts that I'm going to get, and should I know whether or not those are good investments or bad investments? There's different tiers of those types of things. It would be another thing that we would be wanting to mandate at some point to have it on the job listing, because we're going to be questioning whether we have that or not. I can see where you're coming from, right? I understand the concept, because those self-insured programs do not, we're not mandating coverage of those things because we can't. There's a federal thing in the way that requires us to leave those alone. That's part of the reason why you and I both agree a lot of times on the health insurance world is it's so messed up right now that both the state and the Fed don't control the entire thing. And so it seems to be lost at times on who's in charge of what. And then if we can't figure it out, how are our constituents supposed to be able to figure it out? And so I guess my only concern with this bill really is, where does it stop? Where does the mandating stop? Where do we start saying, hey, this job listing now is going to be 200 pages long, and when do we call it quits? Because the other question I have is, how often are these people going to read these things? I agree that I think a diabetic patient or a diabetic individual is going to look for those things, but I don't I don't think everybody will. And I get concerned that if we make them too long, that if they don't ask the question, they'll never know the answer. And I also worry that putting this in there, they'll feel like they don't need to ask the question, but then they find out that, oh, maybe I should have asked the question also. And so I'm a little worried both ways. Does that make sense?
Senator Mann, do you have a response to this being a slippery slope?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't think that, well, right now you provide salary ranges, you provide general benefit information. This falls squarely into general benefit information. I don't ever think that providing too much information is a bad thing.
Thank you. Members, I would also note, just for the purpose of your packets, there's a couple of, I think, important testimonial letters in regard to Senate File 2235 as well. Senator Grünhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Is there an amendment on this one, or is that was hand? Oh, it's the next one. Okay,
no.
I'm sorry.
No.
I was confused. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah. Now, Senator Mann, you know I like some of your bills. I signed on to some of them. In fact, I just complimented you on a nursing home bill you had about evicting certain patients after their private money ran out. and I do appreciate that. On this one, though, I do have similar concerns that Senator Leeske voiced. The other thing is, you know, sometimes these self-insured companies, which tend to be bigger companies, they will have multiple plans to choose from for the employee. So are they going to have to list for each plan in their posting of what the benefit would actually be, let's just say for diabetes?
Senator Mann.
Madam Chair. So no, they don't have to list every plan. They just have to list whether they will offer a plan option that complies with 62Q.
Okay.
Any follow-up, Senator?
Yeah. Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, so they just have to, so if they have five different plans they offer, they can just offer one that provides for that. You know, I think we can start going down the list of medical conditions, and I mean, there's just, I can, you know, I guess I see this as the camel's nose under the tent a little bit. I mean, we can just start going down and down and down and down. And I mean, it's, if I have a severe, somebody in my family or myself even would need, which I don't, would need diabetic information or something, or insulin or some other type of medical treatment, I would, in the interview, make sure that I was able to get a plan like that to provide for that particular need. That would be a big concern of mine. I just think that this is well intended, but I think we're going down a path of additional mandates on self-insured plans, which again, ERISA covers, and it just, there can be no end to this. Unless you can tell me this is it now, we're not gonna see any expansion of this, but you can maybe respond to that.
Senator Mann, any response?
Yeah, so this is not a mandate on plans at all. Has nothing to do with the plans.
No.
And also it saves a step for the employer and the employee. So if the employee or someone who's looking for a job sees on the job posting that if they are diabetic and they see on the job posting that they do not offer this copay, they don't have to go through the trouble of having a job interview, knowing that once they get there, go through the interview, and then they go, oh, do you cover insulin? And they say no, they're not gonna take that job anyways, because they can't. So it saves the employer time, it saves the employee time, and again, nothing to do with mandates on the plans.
Thank you, Senator Mann. Follow-up?
Just one more comment. Well, let's just say that I was applying for a job and I had a certain heart medication that I needed. I mean, why wouldn't we pass a law to require how that heart medication would be covered? You know, if it'd be covered similar to what the private sector plans would have to do. So, I mean, I just think you're going down a road, well-intentioned, but I can see we can just keep adding as we go along. And I think in the long run, it can create the ripple effect of more problems than it actually solves. Those are my thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Any other comments or questions for Senator Mann? Yes, Senator Moore for Baton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for bringing forward the bill, Senator Mann. I would love to sign on, but I feel like this is really important, especially for those folks with chronic conditions who could like go all the way through the process, think you found the job, just to find out that this is not going to work for you and you're not going to have the health care that you need. So I'm all for transparency, and I think we owe that to our community.
Thank you. Anybody else? All right. I second that. I think it's a wonderful idea. I'd also bring up the point that it came to mind as I was hearing some of the comments, just how awkward and uncomfortable it of a burden it must be for an employee in an interview. We all have been through interviews. It's scary. There's a lot of pressure in an interview, and you've done all this preparation, and you're hoping you're going to get this job, and you have to say during one of your big interviews, oh, by the way, I have this medical condition, and I need to know that your health care will pay for the things. Like, that's such a having to breach your own privacy and your own, like, boundaries for what you want to share with people about your own health care or not. And so I think this is an excellent idea to just disclose what's available right off the bat for a whole host of reasons. And I think this fear that this is somehow a slippery slope, we can deal with that if we start seeing long lists, and then we can actually have a discussion that is based in reality. But at this point, we don't have that. So I wholeheartedly support this as well. Would also love to sign up if you have a spot for me. And with that, would you have any final comments before we lay the bill over? All right, thank you very much, Senator Mann. Senate file 2235 is laid over for possible inclusion. Next on our agenda, we have Senate file 1566, and followed by Senate file 1518, both authored by Senator Pappas. Welcome to your committee, Senator Pappas. To your bills.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'll take up Senate File 1566 first. This is a fairly simple and short bill. It just adds a reference to Minnesota statute, which are sections of law that outline Medicaid reimbursement rates, to the definition of nursing home. That's Section 1, and Section 2 removes the direct reference to MS-256R and instead references the definition of nursing home within the definition of nursing home employer. So what it's basically doing is it's aligning definitions of nursing home and nursing home employer. It clarifies that facilities that are licensed by the Department of Health but not reimbursed under 256R, for example, veterans' homes, facilities on tribal land, private pay only facilities, and Medicare only rehabilitation homes are not included under the definition of nursing homes for purposes of the nursing home workforce standards law. So it's a technical clarification. There's been some confusion, and DLI already interprets the language to only apply the standards to this smaller set of nursing homes, but we felt like we need to make sure we have the clarification in law. So I'm sure that was totally confusing to everyone.
It made sense to me. and we also have Josiah Moore here, the legislative director from DLI, to share a little bit of testimony as well. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Josiah Moore. I'm the legislative director at the Department of Labor and Industry, here to testify in support of Senate File 1566, the department's technical proposal. As Senator Pappas mentioned, this bill is about aligning the definitions of nursing home and nursing home employer under the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board, and would clarify that veterans' homes, private pay-only facilities, facilities on tribal land, and Medicare-only rehabilitation homes are not included in the board's purview, which, as Senator Pappas mentioned, is already how the department interprets it. So functionally, this won't change anything. It'll just make things a bit more clear. The department did present the language in this bill to the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board in early January, and the language was not controversial with both the employer and employee members of the board. So, and thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'll remain for any questions.
Very good. Thank you very much. Members, any comments or questions for Senator Pappas or Mr. Moore? Yes, Senator Liske.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, being that I'm also on Health and Human Services, and definitely we've talked about some of this stuff before in that committee, I think this is a pretty straightforward bill. It's just trying to figure out how to fix some of the technical issues that are in there and treat the process correctly. Do we have a path to this bill? Are we laying it over? Are we sending it to the floor so that it can be done? Which way are we working with this?
At this point, we're planning to lay the bill over.
Okay. Sounds good. Just wanted to know where we were at. Thanks.
Yep. Any other comments or questions? Okay, Senator Pappas, any final thoughts?
No, Madam Chair, I've just moved to lay the bill over for possible inclusion.
Thank you very much. Senate File 1566 is laid over for possible inclusion. To your next bill, Senator.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I have an author's amendment, which is the A2 amendment.
Very good. Did you want to say anything about it, or we just...
It's really very simple, Madam Chair. It's just that this is a training bill, and it's not appropriate to send the money to the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board. It's appropriate to send the money to the Commissioner of Labor and Industry, who would be overseeing the training.
Very good. So Senator Pappas moves for the adoption of the A2 amendment to Senate File 1518. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. The A2 amendment is adopted.
Thank you. Thank you very much, members, and thank you, Madam Chair. This, again, it's another simple bill. It provides $1 million over the next biennium in one-time funds to pay for training of nursing home workers by a certified worker organization about their workplace rights under the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board. As a reminder, 2 years ago, we created the board, and last year issued 2 rules with minimum labor standards for the nursing home industry. One requires time and a half pay for the 11 state holidays. That rule is in effect now. The other set a minimum wage for the industry and is contingent on funding from the legislature, and that bill I presented yesterday remotely in the Health and Human Services Committee. Under the NHWSB statute, all workers are required to receive 1 hour of training about their rights under the board every 2 years. The training must be conducted by a certified worker organization and use a curriculum approved by the board. The board has already approved a training curriculum and a process to certify organizations to do the training. The training will include information on the pay and benefits workers are entitled to under the board rules, how they can enforce those rights, how they can participate in the board process, and other topics. While the statute provides for paid time for the workers, it made no provision for the trainers. So we expect that in nursing homes where workers are currently represented by a union, the union will want to provide the training for their own members, and we don't need to pay that. The union will take care of that. But union training will likely cover only about a third of the industry. It'd be helpful if someone else took on the bulk of the work to train workers who are not represented by a union. There are a variety of worker organizations that do work like this and would easily take on this role. Many of them are already working on outreach grants related to earned sick and safe time and paid family medical leave, so this would be a good fit for them. We know from experience that enforcement is a huge challenge, especially for laws in this committee's jurisdiction. We hear all the time about how workers don't know about the laws we've passed to protect them at work. When this happens, employers can, either through inadvertence or through ill will, pay them less than they deserve. If we invest a little bit of money up front, it will help make sure that the huge amount of money we spend on nursing homes actually goes to the workers we all want to support. Workers need to really know their rights, and they need to know what their rights are. So I would appreciate your consideration for this proposal. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator. Members, any discussion or questions for Senator Pappas? Yes, Senator Dornick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Pappas, just a couple questions on the grants, how they work, and you said they're, well, I'll start with there. How do they work? How do they, as far as they apply for them, is there the amount that they get? Just some of the details on that.
Madam Chair, I don't really have that information in the weeds. That would be up to Dolly and the Workforce Standards Board, how they structure the grants.
Senator?
I think that Joshua from DLI could probably tell us how they normally do their grant making.
Okay.
carries.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. Did you hear the question?
I did, yes. Thank you for the question, Senator Dornick. So we do have some information on the certified work organizations as far as how many applications we anticipate receiving. So we anticipate receiving in the range of 10 applications to be a certified worker organization, which does help sort of scope out the universe of, you know, the size of how much grants could be, that sort of thing. But yeah, generally we would expect to receive grant applications from organizations that the board has certified as certified worker organizations, which the application to become one just went live this week. So the process would be, first they would apply to the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board to become a certified worker organization, and then any organization that was certified could then apply for a grant if they chose to do so to help fund their activities. They wouldn't have to apply for a grant if an organization didn't feel they needed funding to cover the costs of providing that training to workers, but they would, once they are certified through the board as a work organization, they would be eligible to apply to the department for that grant, the grant funding that would be considered in this bill.
Follow up, Senator Dornick?
So how does the, the material is already, you have that, the training material is already, you guys have that at Dolly, or are you still preparing it?
Mr. Moore?
Thank you, Senator Dornick. I'm going to defer to my colleague, Leah Solo, the executive director of the board, as that question just touches more on the details of the board's work.
Thanks, Leah.
Thank you for joining us. If you'd introduce yourself for our record, and then I assume you heard the question.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. Senator, thank you for the question. We do have a sample curriculum prepared and up on the website. It's part of the application process for becoming a certified worker organization, is that organizations have to say that they will use use the information that is already agreed upon by the board as the information that is needed to give to workers.
Follow up, Senator Dornick? Okay. I'm going to actually interrupt our questions and discussions because we have a testifier on this bill, and I sort of skipped over that right to our discussion tonight, so I want to backtrack just a little bit. We have Mr. Travis Berth, who is here with SEIU Healthcare, Minnesota, and Iowa. Welcome to the Senate Labor Committee this afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us. And if you'd please introduce yourself for our record, we look forward to hearing your testimony today. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair McEwen and members of the committee. My name is Travis Berth. I live in South St. Paul, Minnesota. I am a server and a cook at Serenity Care Center. I am here on behalf of my union, SEIU Healthcare, Minnesota, and Iowa. Our union represents about 50,000 healthcare workers around the state. We work in hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, and self-directed home care. We support SF 1518 because our industry and your money will work better when workers know their rights. I started working at Serenity in December of 2020. I was one of the few to start in the middle of the COVID epidemic. I thought boot camp in the U.S. Army would be the worst experience of my life. Boot camp was not that bad compared to working in a nursing home that does not have enough staff. When I worked weekends, we would often have just two servers for two whole buildings. Together, we serve 160 people. Things have gotten a little better since COVID. Money from the legislature has helped, but so has giving workers more say through the Nursing Home Standards Board. Because of the board, we got time and a half on our first time on President's Day. I think the prospect of the statewide minimum wage helped me go from $17 to $22.50 an hour. But the nursing home didn't just pass along the money to us. In fact, last year, my coworkers joined the largest ever one-day strike in Minnesota, nursing home workers. Just Friday, we filed for a 10-day notice, and I could be on strike again next week. This bill is about giving more workers the knowledge of their rights and power to enforce them. Just because you fund nursing homes and just because a law or the board tell employers what to do with it does not mean the money winds up in our pocket. For example, when we got our first holiday pay on President's Day, our employer failed to pay us time and a half for that day. It was an honest mistake, and it's getting paid back, but workers had to point it out and demand to get that fixed. Last year, we had a case where a worker was unpaid for over 2 years. We had to win her $4,000 in unpaid wages. For a non-union worker, it's harder to speak up. The training they get from this bill will let them know they are protected. More importantly, without the training funded by this bill, many workers won't know they are entitled to holiday pay and minimum wages. Without the training, it's too easy for the employer to shortchange them. I am not a policy expert, but I can tell you what it feels like to be on the floor of a nursing home. We don't get treated with respect. Our managers pay us as little as they can and get away with it. Our administrators turn over faster than our own staff. The problem is not just a lack of funding. The business press says a lot of people are making money from the nursing homes. More of that money should go to the workers on the floor. We know there are good people in management. They face many of the same challenges that we do. But things work better when workers have a voice on the job. This bill would give more workers a stronger voice. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. All right, now back to member comments and questions. Senator Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I just want to make it clear that anything I say today will not affect any of my bonding projects. No, I'm just kidding. Okay. No, I like the idea here. The only question I have is there, you know, we have these organizations fill out these forms, and maybe the gentleman who spoke about this, Josiah? Yeah, if he'd come forward.
From DLI?
Yeah.
You have to sit in the front row. Just oh, they're plugging it in.
Okay, thank you. The question is, okay, we're giving this money out to these organizations to go do this training, okay, which I understand to a certain degree, but is there any reporting required by those organizations as to how many people they reached and with the amount of money that was given? In other words, we've had a lot of problems with giving out money to nonprofits in this state, and to the tune of over $600 million that we know of, and it sounds like there's even more in terms of waste, fraud, and abuse. But so my question is, okay, we got this $1 million, we're giving it out to these organizations. Do they have to report back on what they actually accomplished to the agency or organization or to the government in any way?
Mr. Moore.
Thank you for the question, Senator Gruenhagen. I know that there are some grants requirements that sort of govern these processes generally that I would expect to apply, but I'm not an expert, so I would have to follow up with sort of the details of any grants management requirements that would apply. And I think there is also a side to this where there are statutory requirements of certified worker organizations themselves and certain information they may be responsible to communicate outside of the context of these grants. So if the question is about that at all, I think Director Solo could speak to what sort of reporting requirements or information certified work organizations need to be able to share with the board.
Great. Welcome back.
Might we just stay here?
After you.
Thank you, Chair, Senator. So the in the application, we actually ask as potential certified worker organizations to tell us how many people they think that they'll be able to train, what shifts they're available to train in, as we know that workers may be working an overnight shift, and maybe that is a time where they are able to do a training. So we have some of those pieces in the application, and that in our rules, we said that the board would actually keep a running list of what organizations had said that they're available to do. Additionally, in statute, there is a requirement that employers report to the board that all of their workers have been trained. So there will be some reporting back that workers have been trained. And then the board has determined that there will be a sort of an audit process for a certain percentage of employers to ensure that those trainings have happened. So that's the board's part of this work.
Thank you. Follow-up, Senator Grunhagen.
Yeah, just real quickly. Oh, thank you. Thanks for that information and response. But I guess my question centers more on, I know it's in the application, but then they get this money if they're approved, then do they have to report back, this is how many employees we trained with this amount of money? Because then what I like to do is take, okay, you spent this amount of money, you trained this many employees, you divide it out, and you get a pretty good idea the cost per employee. So if this organization can do it twice as cheap as the other organization, maybe we should favor this organization over here with a little more money rather than the other one. And, you know, so that's kind of the, is there anything that requires that type of reporting back so people understand, that people in the state understand, you know, okay, they were given this much money, they trained this many employees, and this was the result. So I'm talking more of a result than just the application of organizations that were approved.
Any response at all?
Chair, Senator, I think since this isn't a function that we currently do, sure. I personally don't have an answer at this moment, but I think that that is a good question.
Yeah. Mr. Moore, at all?
I would just reiterate that I can follow up with information about what grant reporting requirements this would be subject to.
Thank you. Yeah, I agree. I think it's a good question, and just to have a good tracking of, like, how much, you know, per money, how many people are being trained per certain grants is good information to have. Yeah, Senator Grunhagen.
Yeah, and I mean, look at the results we've had just recently. I mean, in the last few years, the amount of money that's just disappeared. You know, and I guess what's been in the news lately is feeding our future. You know, we'd be.
No, there was just a big conviction on that. So we're going to go back, though, to the topic at hand right now.
The point is we've just been sending these checks out, and we never got any reports back. And the next thing you know,
and then they reported it to the law officials. That's right. Anybody else? Yes, Senator Dornick.
Just a quick question on as far as the grant. And the number was never given. So we have $1 million. How do we come up with that $1 million amount? Do we have a, you know, just some numbers that you kind of crunch to get to that number, just so, is that going to be enough? Is it going to be too much?
Madam Chair, it's kind of an imperfect number. I mean, it's kind of an estimate of what might be needed to train this number of workers. We haven't had a lot of experience with this type of system, so it's kind of an experiment, and it may be that that we don't need this much, maybe we need a little bit more. So it was trying to find kind of a middle ground to get the job done.
Follow-up, Senator Dornick.
Madam Chair, yeah, thank you for that. I guess as we go through, definitely I think that needs some work or some tweaking, and look forward to, you know, hearing a little bit more about it as it goes through the process. So thank you.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make one comment that's kind of off the topic in response to Senator Grunhagen.
Yes.
Is I just want to assure you that in the capital investment process, we are very on top of our grants for both local governments and state agencies. We have a very, you know, I think we as legislators don't do as good a job as we could, because we know that we've got DEED that develops contracts with everyone that we're giving money to. We have MMB that's overseeing everything. And right now, I'm actually even personally talking to every legislator that received an appropriation, the 23 bill. Have you followed up with your grant? Are they working out a contract? Are they drawing down the money? And also, where we pay at a reimbursement rate, so you have to have already spent the money and then you submit invoices. So in that process, there's a great deal of accountability. Right. And then just to get back to the topic here,
yes.
Is There is a problem with wage theft across a lot of industries, and this industry is not exempt from that process. I'll just give you one local example in that I just read in the paper. The U.S. Department of Labor obtained a consent judgment in federal court requiring a Minneapolis private in-home care provider to pay $1.6 million in back wages and damages as part of the department's effort to recover unpaid overtime wages for 136 healthcare workers in the Twin Cities area. And there's even some more egregious cases in other parts of the country, but that's the one I wanted to point out that actually happened in our state. Thanks. So I would appreciate your support for this bill.
Thank you very much, Senator Pappas. Any other questions or comments? Okay. Very good. Do you have any? I think that was a good final word. Yeah. Thanks, everyone, for your testimony and for talking about Senate File 1518. So Senate File 1518, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much, members, and all of the testifiers from today. With that concludes our business for today, and the Senate Labor Committee is adjourned.